Osho, Tao, The Pathless Path, Volume 2, talks and extracts from the Lita Zoo, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 1.
Bhagwan, Huiyang visited King Kang of Sung. The king stamped his foot, coughed and said fiercely, "What pleases me is courage and strength. I take no pleasure in men who preach morality. What have you to teach me?" "Suppose that I have a way to make anyone, however brave and strong, miss when he stabs or strikes at you. Wouldn't your majesty be interested?" "Excellent. This is the sort of thing I like to hear. But even if a stab or blow misses, it is still humiliating for you. Suppose that I have a way to prevent anyone, however brave and strong, from daring to stab or strike you. But a man who does not dare to harm you may still have the will to harm you. Suppose that I have a way to ensure that men have absolutely no will to harm you. But a man who has no will to harm you may still have no thought of loving or benefiting you. Suppose that I have a way to make every single man and woman in the world joyfully desire to love and benefit you. This is 3 degrees better than courage and strength. Isn't your majesty interested? This is the sort of way I should like to find." "The teaching of Confucius and Mo Tzu is what I have in mind. Confucius and Mo Tzu became princes without owning territory, became leaders without holding office. Every man and woman in the world craned his neck and stood on tiptoe in his eagerness for their safety and benefit. Now your majesty is lord of 10,000 chariots. If you were indeed to share the aims of these two men, everyone within your four borders would enjoy the benefit. You would be far greater than Confucius and Mao Tzu." Huiyang hurried out, and the king said to his courtiers, "Clever, the way he talked me round with his argument."
Tao means transcendence, transcendence of all duality, transcendence of all polarity, transcendence of all opposites. Tao is the ultimate synthesis, synthesis of man and woman, of the positive and the negative, life and death, day and night, summer and winter. But how this synthesis becomes possible? How one has to grow into that ultimate synthesis? Few things have to be understood. First, the principle of yin, the principle of feminine, is like a ladder. Ladder between the hell and heaven. You can go to the hell through it, and you can go to heaven through it. The direction will differ, but the ladder will be the same. And that ladder is the principle of yin, the principle of femininity. Nothing happens without the women. The energy of the women is the ladder of the lowest and of the highest, of the darkmost valley and of the lightest peak. This is one of the fundamental principles of Tao. It has to be understood in detail. Once it gets root into your heart, things will become very simple. It will be good to go into the symbol of Adam and Eve. The world does not start with Adam. It starts with Eve. It is through Eve that the serpent persuades Adam to disobey. The serpent could not persuade Adam directly, as if there is no direct way to the man. If you want to reach the man, you have to go through the woman. Woman functioned as a medium for the evil. Again, when Christ is born, he is born out of Virgin Mary. The Christ child is born out of virgin femininity, out of virgin in. Again, the highest enters through the woman. The lowest and the highest both happen through the woman. Adam means earth, clay. Exactly red earth. Because God made Adam out of earth. Adam is the principle of dust unto dust. Man is the outer principle, the principle of extroversion. Man is the physical body. Try to understand these symbols. Man is the physical body. Then God created Eve out of man's physical body. Something higher. First man has to be created, then woman. Something subtler. Something more refined. Something of a greater synthesis. Eve is created out of a rib. Eve cannot be created directly from the earth. For example, you cannot eat mud, but you can eat apples. Apples are on a higher plane. They come out of the mud. The tree grows out of the mud. The apple is nothing but earth transformed. You can eat the apple and you can digest it. But if you try to eat the earth, you will die. Apple is from the earth but is a superior synthesis. Better, more digestible. God created Adam. Man has taken it as if God created man first, so he is first. No. Man is created first because he is very close to the earth. Then the woman is created. She is not so close to the earth. She is created out of Adam. She is a higher synthesis. And the name of Eve is also very significant. It means the heart. Adam means earth and Eve means the heart. God had told Adam to name things. He named everything. And when he came to name Eve, he simply said loudly, "She is my heart, Eva." That became Eve's name. Eva or Eve means the heart. Translated into modern jargon, it will mean the psyche. Man is the body principle, woman is the psyche. Man is body, woman is mind. Everything happens through the mind. If you do bad, first your mind has to be convinced about it. If you do good, your mind has to be convinced about it. Everything happens first as an idea. Then it can be actualized. Your body cannot be persuaded to do something unless your mind is ready. Even if illness enters your body, it enters through the mind. Anything that ever happens, happens through the mind. That is the meaning of the whole parable, that the serpent persuaded Eve. Only mind can be persuaded, convinced, seduced. And then the mind can persuade the body very easily. In fact, the body follows the mind like a shadow. Once your mind has got its thoughts, it is bound to be translated into actuality. Through Eve, Adam fell. Through Eve, he was expelled from the garden of God. Through Eve came this great adventure we call the world. Through Eve he disobeyed. I have heard a man was brought to a court and the policeman said either he is mad or he is completely drunk, because he was just standing in the middle of the road and I told him many times to move from there but he will not move, and I am surprised because I don't think that he is drunk and I don't think that he is mad. In every way he seems to be sane, and I smelled his mouth and he has not drunk, but he will not move from there. So the magistrate asked, tell me, and the man is a very tiny man, very weak, thin, why you were standing there, why you didn't move? When the policeman was saying you again and again, he said, sir, I had to choose between the law of the government and the law of my wife. He said, what do you mean? He said, my wife has told me to meet me exactly on that spot at 12 o'clock. So I had to choose. Naturally, I had chosen the law of my wife. The magistrate laughed and he said, that has been always the case. You go home. If that is the problem, then one has to choose the law of the wife. Since Adam, it has been so. But the woman is the principle of the inner. Not certainly of the innermost, but of the inner. See, just in the middle. The innermost you call the soul, the outermost the body, and just between the two is the psyche, the mind. Adam went on this adventure of the world, following Eve. And then, again, the parable is the same with Jesus. Jesus is born out of Virgin Mary. Why virgin? Because if you understand rightly, virgin means a mind which is absolutely pure, uncontaminated by thought. Thoughts are represented by the serpent, because the ways of the thought are very serpentine. If you watch your thoughts, you will understand why they have been represented by the serpent. Their ways are very serpentine. Just like serpents, they walk without legs. They wriggle within you. And they are very cunning and very clever and very deceptive. Like the serpent. They hide in the dark holes in your unconscious. And whenever they have an opportunity, they jump upon you. In the night, in the dark night, they come out. In the daylight, they hide. When you are a little alert, those thoughts disappear. When you are not so alert, they come out. They start influencing you. Virgin Mary means a mind in meditation. Eve means a mind full of thoughts, full of serpents. Jesus enters again into the world through Virgin Mary, through purity, through innocence. Thought is cunning, thoughtlessness is innocence. If you understand these beautiful parables, you will be surprised. We have not done justice with them. They are not historical facts. They are great metaphors of the inner being of man. Through Adam, through Eve, Adam fell. And through Virgin Mary, Jesus rose, entered again into the world of God. One thing more. It is said that the sin of Adam was disobedience. God has said not to eat the fruit of a certain tree, the tree of knowledge. But the serpent persuaded Eve and the Eve persuaded Adam. It was disobedience. You will be surprised to know that the Hebrew meaning of Mary means rebellion. The Hebrew word is Miriam. It means rebellion. Through disobedience, Adam fell, and through rebellion, Jesus rose. Disobedience means a reaction, going against God. Rebellion means now negating the negative. Now going against the world, going against the serpents. Eve listened to the serpents and went against God. Jesus rebelled against the serpents and listened to God. Rebellion is religious. Disobedience is political. Disobedience only brings disorder. Rebellion, real rebellion, brings a radical change in your being. A 180-degree turn, a conversion. But Adam or Jesus both happen through the feminine principle. In Taoist language, the feminine principle is called in. And the male principle is called yang. Yang is ambition. Yang is aggression. Yang is desire, projection. Yang is political. In is religious. Whenever you are ambitious, it is impossible for you to be religious. Whenever you are religious, it is impossible for you to be political. They don't go together. They don't mix. They cannot mix. Their very nature is such, as if you are trying to mix water and oil. Ambition and meditation never mix. They cannot mix. The politician functions through the male principle, and the sage functions through the feminine principle. That's why the sages become so soft, so feminine, so round, so beautiful. A certain grace surrounds them. And the beauty is certainly not only of the body. Sometimes it happens that the body may not be beautiful at all. In the early Christianity, there was a principle of Jesus being the ugliest person in the world. By and by, Christians dropped that idea. They didn't like it, but it had something beautiful in it. It said that the body was ugliest, but still, when you will come across Jesus, you will be suddenly surprised, overtaken, possessed, overwhelmed by his beauty. His body was ugly. If you had seen a picture, you will see only his ugliness. But if you had come to him in his actual presence, you will forget all about his ugliness. So much beauty was flowing. So much beauty was overpouring, raining, that you will not even remember that he is ugly. So those who have not seen him used to think that he is ugly, and those who had seen him used to contradict that he is the most beautiful person. The body is not the question. The sage lives not in the body, lives through the body, but not in the body, not as the body. The politician is nothing but the body, the extrovert. The body is extrovert, the psyche is introvert. When you transcend both, Tao arises. When you are neither extrovert nor introvert, when you are not going into the outer and not going into the inner, you are not going anywhere. There is tremendous stillness. No movement, because no motivation. Your inner flame is no more wavering, because there is no direction to go, there is no purpose to fulfill. There is nowhere to be and nobody else to be. You are absolutely content with the moment. Then you have transcended man and woman and the polarity. In that transcendence is Tao. This transcendence has been taught in different ways, all over the world, in different terms. One term I would like to explain to you, it will help. The word is Israel. It is not a name of a certain race, certainly not of the Jews. It is not a name of a certain individual. Israel is exactly what Tao is. Try to understand. Israel is made of three symbols. Is, Ra, El. Is means the feminine principles. Is comes from the Egyptian word Isis. Isis means the moon goddess. Moon is the feminine principle. Remember the word moon, because in Hindu metaphors also the moon is the symbol of the feminine. In yoga also, they say there are three passages in the human being: the moon, the sun, and the transcendental. From one nostril, you breathe the moon energy. from another nostril you breathe the sun energy. And deep inside, when both breathings stop, then you transcend. That is called Susumna. Ida, Pingla, Susumna. Israel is made of three symbols. Is comes from Isis, the Egyptian goddess of moon, or Babylonian goddess Ishtar. That too is the moon goddess. It is the principle of in, feminine. Ra comes from the Egyptian sun god. It represents the masculine principle, yang. And El comes from Elohim. The same root from Mohammedan derive Allah. The Hebrew word for God is Elohim. El comes from there. It represents the meeting of the feminine and the masculine and their transcendence to Tao. Israel exactly means Tao. If you are dominated by the sun, you will be aggressive, madly aggressive, ambitious, political, hot, burning with desire and passion. If you are dominated by the moon, you will be cool, non-ambitious, non-aggressive, receptive, peaceful, silent. But both have to be transcended, because both are lopsided. One has to come to a moment when one can say, I am neither man nor woman. That's where a man becomes a Buddha, or a man becomes a Christ, or a man becomes a Krishna, when he is neither man nor woman, neither moon nor sun. Neither is nor Ra, neither in nor yang. One simply is, purely is. All formulations have disappeared. But this happening happens only by and by. First you have to drop the principle of Ra, the principle of sun, the male principle, and you have to move into the feminine, into the female, and from there you have to move into the beyond. Everything happens through the feminine principle. Remember it. Always remember it. It is the middle principle. So whether you are going beyond or you are coming below, makes no difference. It is the ladder. With the body, with the sun energy, with the male, you become a rapist. You rape on life. You are not a lover. Science comes out of sun energy. Science is male oriented. That's why the East could not develop it. East has lived through the moon principles. Passive, silent, easy going, not trying to conquer. In deep love with nature, but not trying to fight. East has never been a rapist. West has raped with nature. Hence the problem of ecology has arisen. All nature is destroyed. With the feminine principle, with the moon principle, there is love. You love, but you don't rape. And sometimes The physical act may be the same, may look like the same, but the innermost quality is different. I have heard about a woman who was complaining against a man into the court. And the magistrate asked, again and again you say that this man raped you. When he raped you? And the woman said, when? January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. The whole year, rape and rape and rape and nothing else. The magistrate was surprised. He said, how he can rape the whole year? And the woman says, he is my husband. But then why you call it rape? Because legally then it is not rape. The woman says, it is still rape. He has not loved me. You can rape even with your wife if you don't love her. The physical act may be the same of making love or raping a woman, but the inner quality differs. With the sun energy is born science. It is a rape on nature. With the moon energy is born poetry, art, painting, dance, music. It is love play with the nature. East has lived through art, through music, dance, drama. West has been trying to use male energy too much. The West has lost balance, so has East. Because no society has yet evolved which can be called Israel, which can be called Tao, which has transcended both, or synthesized both in such a harmony that the antagonism has disappeared. Tao is the goal, to create a human being fully integrated, totally integrated, and also to create a human society totally integrated. Now, this is story. These few things that I have told you will help you to understand it. Hui Eng, visiting King Kong of Sung. The king stamped his foot, coughed, and said fiercely, "What pleases me is courage and strength. I take no pleasure in men who preach morality. What have you to teach me?" Now look at the attitude. This is not an attitude of somebody who wants to learn. The attitude of the rapist who wants to snatch. The king stamped his foot, coughed, and said fiercely, "What pleases me is courage and strength. I take no pleasure in men who preach morality. What have you to teach me?" This is no way to learn. This is insulting. No master will agree to teach this man. In fact, no master will visit the palace of such a man. This man is unworthy of even talked to. But this Hui Ang is a Confucian. Disciples of Confucius used to go to the court. Their whole effort was to persuade the politicians, the ministers, the kings, the princes. They thought that if you can persuade the king, you can change the whole society. Oldest illusion, ancient most illusion, that if you can persuade the politician, it will be easy to change the society. Or if you can change the politician, it will be easy to change the society. Or if you can change the ruling party, it will be easy to change the society. It has never happened. You can change the politician. You can even convince the politician about beautiful things, but deep down the politician remains the politician. He understands only one language, the language of ambition, the language of greed, the language of the world. He is outgoing, extrovert. He cuffed, stamped his foot and said fiercely, "What pleases me is courage and strength." The moment you say that you have some prejudice, the moment you say that this pleases me and this does not please me, you can never learn what truth is, because truth has no need to fit with your pleasures. Truth has no obligation to fit with what pleases you and what does not please you. You have to fit with truth. Truth has not to fit with you. It is said that there are two categories of men in the world. One, who would like truth to stand by their side, and the other, who would like to stand by the side of truth. The first category is that of the politician, the aggressive, the sun energy, the ambitious. The second category is that of the religious, the moon principles, the non-aggressive, receptive. Remember this, never want that truth should stand by your side, because whatsoever stands by your side, is ready to stand by your side, cannot be truth. It must be a lie. Only lies are ready to stand by your side. Truth never. You will have to stand by the side of truth. If you have that much courage to drop your old prejudices, likes and dislikes, only then you can grow into truth, otherwise not. Now what this man says, look at his gesture. He stamped his foot, cuffed and said fiercely, "What pleases me is courage and strength. I take no pleasure in men who preach morality." Yes, how a politician can take any interest in morality? Because morality comes from the feminine principles. Look, all the great teachers of the world have created more femininity in the world. Buddha, Christ, Krishna. They all have created more and more feminine, the soft. Friedrich Nietzsche has criticized Buddha and Jesus both, that they were not real men. And he is right. He says they have discarded manliness. And he is right. Right for wrong reasons, but still right. Buddha, certainly. Mahavir, certainly, Christ, certainly, have taught something which will make you less aggressive, which will make you less violent. And if you listen to them totally, you will become absolutely non-violent. Naturally, Nietzsche cannot like it. He says, the most beautiful thing in the world is the soldier. And the greatest music is the war music. And he says that in my whole life experience, the only moment that I remember again and again, which I can call the most beautiful moment, was when a group of soldiers were marching on the roads, their legs, their feet falling in tune, their boots making a rhythmic noise, their swords shining in the sun, erect, powerful, aggressive, ambitious, in the sun. When I saw this group of soldiers marching, that was the greatest moment of beauty that I know. If such a man comes across Buddha, he will think how Buddha can be beautiful, sitting under the tree, so silent that you can almost forget about him. He is almost absent. His music is that of silence. His music is that of receptivity. He is just a cool phenomenon. No heat, no passion, no desire. Sitting silently there, he is almost like a tree. Flowering there, he is almost like a tree. And in the East, particularly in India, we have thought of a Buddha as a lotus flower who has bloomed fully, 1,000 petals lotus flower. Yes, almost like a tree. For 500 years in India, the statue of Buddha was not made. Instead of the statue of Buddha, people worshipped the tree. Yeah, many statues were made of the tree. Many pictures were made of the tree. Many paintings were made of the tree. Many temples were built. But there was no statue of Buddha, just the Bodhi tree. Because Buddha was almost absent. He had become formless. He had become as if he was not. His music is that of silence. Nietzsche will not recognize the beauty of it. No politician will recognize the beauty of it. This king said, I take no pleasure in men who preach morality. The base of all morality is to love. And the base of all politics is to hate. The moralist says, love even your enemy. And the politician says, hate even your friend. If you want to see in contrast, you can read Jesus and Machiavelli. Or the Indian parallel, you can read Buddha and Chanakya. It is not just a coincidence that the part of Delhi where Indian politicians live is called Chanakyapuri. It is named after Chanakya, the Indian Machiavelli. Machiavelli says, don't even trust your friends. Don't say anything even to your friend which you would not like to say to your enemy. Why? Because he says, who knows, your friend may turn your enemy tomorrow. So don't say anything that you would not like to be said to an enemy. And look at Jesus, he says, even if somebody slaps on your one cheek, give him the other too. Love your enemy as yourself. Naturally, politicians cannot be ready to listen to the teachings of morality. Morality means love, and politics means hate, hatred. Politicians may smile, but hidden behind that smile is a horrible face. They may show a beautiful face, but behind it they are preparing for hell. They may talk about peace, but they prepare for war. Their whole life depends on destruction. Love is creation, hate is destruction. Naturally, the king was not interested in any kind of morality. He said, what pleases me is courage and strength. And why courage and strength? Why strength? Jesus says, blessed are the meek. Not blessed are the strong. No. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the humble. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Not the strong. Not the strong-headed. But those who have soft heart. Not people like rocks, but people like flowers. They are blessed. And Jesus is right. But no politician will like to listen to this. This is nonsense. The politician cannot understand this language. He has his own language. The language of cunning, calculation, hatred, domination, destruction. The politician lives on evil. How can he listen to morality? Remember, the language of politics is not the language of religion, and the language of religion is not the language of politics. In fact, they are so far apart that they cannot even be translated into each other. Impossible. They are not only two languages, they are two different planes, two different worlds, two separate realities. In a way, the king is sincere. He is showing his real face. The king stamped his foot, cuffed, and said fiercely, what pleases me is courage and strength. And why courage? Why people have talked so much about courage? To kill people and to be killed. Why so much strength has been praised? Because without strength it is difficult to rape nature. It is difficult to rape other people. It is difficult to conquer, dominate. It is difficult to destroy. When a religious person talks of courage, his courage has a different meaning, remember. And when he talks of his strength has a totally different meaning, remember. When a religious person calls something courageous, he does not mean the same thing as the politician. For the religious, courage means to be creative. Courage means to be oneself. Courage means to be sincere, authentic. Courage means not to yield to lies. Courage means not to allow corruption to set in one's own being. Courage means to resist all temptations of going astray. Courage does not mean the capability to kill and be killed. No. Courage means the capacity to live and live your own life according to your own heart. And strength does not mean capacity of violence. Strength means capacity to understand. Capacity to know, capacity to love, capacity to be open. When somebody hits you, it is not strength to hit him back. It is very simple. Anybody can do it. Even a child can do it. But when somebody hits you and you don't hit, it is instant. When Jesus was crucified and he prayed to God, Father, forgive these people because they don't know what they are doing. It is instant. The strength of the meek, the power of the humble. Remember, the same word, if used by different people, becomes different. In fact, there should be dictionaries, religious dictionary, political dictionary, different dictionaries there should be. In a better world, they will be. Because the same words cannot mean the same. A diner in a restaurant rushed over to a man who was standing just near the door. "I have been robbed," he screamed. "I turned my head and someone stole my brown top coat. It had buttons on the sleeves and a fur collar." "Hmm?" murmured the stranger who was standing on the door. "Come to think of it, I saw a man walking out of here just a few minutes ago, wearing that very coat." "Quick, quick," demanded the customer. "What did the guy look like?" "Terrible," the man sighed. "The sleeves were much too short for him." Then, looking the surprised look on the robbed man, he added immediately, "You see, I am a tailor." Your language is your language. The words have no meaning in themselves. The meaning is brought by the person who uses them. A rancher applied for a loan at a bank. "How much do you want to borrow?" asked the loan interviewer. $25,000. "All right, but you will have to show security. How many bulls do you have on your ranch?" 200. "That would be enough security. The loan is approved." Several months later, the rancher returned to the bank to repay the loan. "Here is your money," he declared, peeling off bills from a huge bankroll. "Well, sir, let me congratulate you on your sudden prosperity," said the interviewer, eyeing the bankroll. "And for safety's sake, may I suggest you deposit that extra money in our bank?" Staring at him coldly, the rancher asked, "How many bulls do you have?" Everybody has his own language. The politician has very certain language, definite language. Certainly, morality is not part of it. Deception, immorality. By any means and methods, one has to fulfill one's ambition. So, even if a politician uses morality, he uses only as a means. Sometimes a politician may look very moral if it fulfills his purpose. It happened. Mahatma Gandhi was a politician, not a religious man at all. When India was fighting with the Britishers, non-violence was fulfilling the purpose. When India became free, then the ideology of non-violence became defunct. Then it was not of much use. Even Gandhi approved of Indian military army. And when India attacked and was getting ready to attack Pakistan, he blessed. When he saw aeroplanes flying over Delhi towards Pakistan, he said, "Good, with my blessings." Now what has happened? This is the same man who was against all violence. But then, violence was not possible. India was not in a situation to fight the British violently. Non-violence was in favor. Gandhi used it. But when India became independent then he forgot all his talk about non-violence. Then he will not say that dissolve the army now. Dissolve the police force. Let the country be ruled by love. He forgot all about non-violence. That's why I say he was a politician. If he was a religious person, then this was the real opportunity to be non-violent. The country had become free. Now you should have dissolved all military, all army, all police force. In fact, you should have dropped government itself, because government is a violent organization. But then he kept mum. A politician can use morality when it serves his purpose. He can say honesty is the best policy, but remember, it is a policy. It serves the purpose. Policy means politics. But when dishonesty is the best policy, then when it serves the purpose, then perfectly okay. Politician is like a horse. He can change. He is opportunistic. Whatsoever serves his purpose becomes his ideal and his principle. Deep down, there is only one principle that his ambition has to be fulfilled. The king was in a way sincere. I take no pleasure in men who preach morality. What have you to teach me? Suppose, said Huiyang, that I have a way to make anyone, however brave and strong, miss when he steps or strikes at you, would not your majesty be interested? Now, no Taoist will do this. First, the Taoist will not go to the king. The king will have to come to the Taoist. Even then, he may not like to see the king. Because he knows the politician is the worst possible. In Buddhist classification, they have divided man in three categories. First, they call Adham Purush, the lowest, the worst man. Second, they call Madhyam Purush, the middle man. And third, they call Mahapurush, the great man. Mahapurush is one who lives naturally, religiously, without any ambition and without any mind. Is just a part of this cosmos, not fighting, not struggling, floating with it, flowing with it, is in a deep let go. That is Mahapurush, the great man. Then next to him comes the middleman, who is not totally in the flow, but sometimes there are moments when he flows. Sometimes there are moments when he freezes. Sometimes he starts fighting and sometimes he relaxes. He has a double bind. He is in the middle. Sometimes he moves to the lower, sometimes to the higher. He is still wavering. He has not yet become decisive. His integration is not complete yet. And then comes the third, the lowest, Adhampurus, the worst. He is settled at the lowest. He does not want to move from there. The politician is Adhampurus, the worst. The artist is the Madhyampurus, the middleman. And the religious is Mahapurus, the great man. And beyond the three is the fourth, the Turi, one who has gone beyond all categories, the non-categorized. He is in Tao. He is beyond politics, he is beyond art, he is beyond even religion. He is simply beyond. No Taoist will go to teach a king. That is foolish, stupid. The disciple has to come to the master. Why? Because unless the disciple comes and seeks, he is not ready to learn. The disciple has to be humble. If a disciple stands his foot cuffed and said fiercely, "What do you have to teach me?" then it is better not to teach him. He is incurable. But there is the difference between the Confucius and the Taoist. Confucius and his followers were constantly traveling and going to the kings and the ministers and the powerful people and trying to convert them and trying to convince them. They thought that seems to be the easiest way to change the world. That has always been thought. That if you want to change humanity, the best way goes to the capital. No, it has proved wrong, absolutely wrong. For 5,000 years at least, we know well the way to transform man does not go through the capital. It goes through the heart, not through the capital. And you can change only a person who is ready to be changed, who is willing to be changed, who is cooperative, who is ready to learn and bow down and surrender to receive. But Hui Eng tried. He said, "Suppose that I have a way to make anyone, however brave and strong, miss when he stabs or strikes at you, would not your majesty be interested?" Now he is trying to persuade the king in his own language. Never do that. Because when you bring religion to the level of the worst man, religion is despised. Tao cannot be translated into the language of greed, but this is what Hui Eng is doing. Trying to translate desirelessness into greed. The king became interested. He said, "Excellent. Look the change." Just a moment before he was stamping his foot, coughing and was saying fiercely, "What do you have to teach me? And I don't want to listen about morality." "Excellent," he says. "This is the sort of thing I like to hear." Now this comes close. It is not going to change him. In fact, religion has come down to adjust with him. He has not gone up to adjust with religion. This is very irreligious. To do such a thing is irreligious. this man Hui Eng is falling into the trap of the politician rather than helping the politician to come out of his imprisonment. He himself is falling in the trap. To persuade the king, he is bringing truth almost to the level of a lie. What he says, if I can persuade someone, however brave and strong, miss when he steps or strikes at you. This seems good to the ego, to the greedy ego, that if this can be done, then I will become unconquerable. Now this comes close to ambition. This is worth. This becomes a policy. This becomes a strategy. Excellent, this is the sort of thing I like to hear. Remember always, the sort of thing that you like to hear is bound to be wrong. Because the sort of man you are, how can you like to hear the right thing? It is very difficult to be ready to hear the truth. It shatters. It confuses. It uproots. It shocks. It dismantles. It destroys your prejudices. It hits you hard. In fact, it tries to kill you as you have existed up to now. That's why very rare people are ready to hear the truth. If I was going to talk in terms of life, you would have find millions of people around here. I was talking to thousands and thousands of people. Great crowds used to gather. But then by and by I recognize the fact that they gather not to hear what I am to say, they gather to hear what they want to hear. They are not there to be transformed. They are there to be consoled. They are there to be convinced wherever they are and whatsoever they are, they want to know that they are right. The moment I started saying the truth, they started disappearing. Now only rarely few people will be coming to me. Because I don't make any compromise. I will say only that which is true. If you want to agree with it, good. If you want it to agree with you, then this is not the place for you. But even if a stab or blow misses it, it is still humiliating for you. Now he persuades more. He says, I can teach a certain art, so nobody can stab you. Or even if he stabs, he will miss. Now he sees that the king is ready, persuaded. The king says, excellent, this is the sort of thing I like to hear. Now he moves ahead. He says, but even if a stab or blow misses, it is still humiliating for you. Somebody tried to kill, though he missed, but even the effort on your life is humiliating. I can do something for that too. Suppose that I have a way to prevent anyone, however brave and strong, from daring to stab or strike you. I can do something more. I can create such a situation that he will not even dare to stab or make an effort on your life. What about you? What about it, sir? But a man who does not dare to harm you may still have the will to harm you. He may not dare, but he has the idea. Even that is humiliating, that somebody thinks to destroy you. Suppose that I have a way to ensure that men have absolutely no will to harm you. But A man who has no will to harm you may still have no thought of loving or benefiting you. A man may have no thought to harm you, but that does not make it sure that he wants to benefit you or has a loving attitude towards you. Suppose that I have a way to make every single man and woman in the world joyfully desire to love and benefit you. This is 3 degrees better than courage and strength. Is not your majesty interested? This is the sort of way I should like to find, said the king. Now, truth is brought to the level of the Adham Purush, the lowest man. In bringing truth to the lowest man, truth loses its quality of being true. It becomes a falsehood. Now it is a lie. Now it is clever argument. It is no more a statement of truth. It is a cunning device. It is sophistry. Yes, exactly that is the word for it. This man is not a sage. He is a sophist. You must have heard about sophists. In Yunnan, in Greek, they existed. Before Socrates, there was a great power in the hands of the sophists. They traveled all over the country. They convinced everybody. They were great arguers. But they had no principles. Whatsoever you want to be convinced about, they will convince you. That was the start of prostitution. They were paid. They became very affluent. Because they were ready to support anything. Just you tell me what you want to be convinced of, they will say, and they will convince you, and they will give you beautiful arguments. They had schools to teach people argumentation. Because of Socrates, they disappeared from the world. Socrates had a great impact on the Greek mind. And he destroyed that whole prostitution. Bertrand Russell used to say again and again a small story. I don't know from where he got, but the story is beautiful, so there is no need to worry about it. He used to say, quote again and again, that one day a sophist came to see Socrates. He had his beautiful dog with him. And Socrates looked at him and asked, "Is this your dog?" And the sophist said, "Yes." And Socrates says, "Is the dog male or female?" And the sophist says, "A female." And Socrates asked, "Is the dog a mother or not yet a mother?" And the sophist says, "Yes, the dog is a mother." And Socrates laughed and said, "You are the son of it, you son of a bitch." I don't know from where Bertrand Russell got it. But sophists were that type of people. They had no principles. They had no truth. They were opportunists. And they were ready to argue for anything. Wrong or right was not the question. They simply enjoyed argumentation. They were like liars. You go to the liars. It does not matter whether you are wrong or right. He is ready to support you. He is ready to fight for you. Mullah Nasruddin went to a liar and told him the whole story. And the liar said, "Don't be worried. Your victory is absolutely certain, 100% certain. You trust me. Leave it to me. You are going to win." And Mullah Nasruddin got up and started getting out of the office. And the liar said, "Where are you going? You have not said anything." He said, "Then there is no need, because I have told you the other man's story, the other side's story. Then there is no need to fight." But this is no way to judge. You say any story and the liar says, "Yes, you are going to win." And he will support you. And he will argue for you. He has no interest in truth. His only interest is if he is paid rightly, that's okay. Then whom he is serving, truth or untruth, does not matter. It is immaterial. He serves money, prestige, power, respectability. If these things are coming, he is ready to support anybody. He is not against crime. He is ready to protect crime, if that is the way money comes. Now this man is a sophist. He is not a sage. He is not a master. He is not even a teacher. Not even an honest teacher. He is a sophist. But he has persuaded the king. This is the sort of way I would like to find. But now, there is nothing to find. The teaching of Confucius and Motazu is what I have in mind, said Hui Eng. He is a disciple of Confucius and Motazu. Motazu is a disciple of Confucius. Just as Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu are the two topmost Taoists, so Confucius and Motazu are the two topmost Confucianists. Confucius and Motazu became princes without owning territory. Now, he flatters the king even more. He buttresses him more. The teaching of Confucius and Motazu is what I have in mind. Confucius and Motazu became princes without owning territory, became leaders without holding office. Every man and woman in the world craned his neck and stood on tiptoe in his eagerness for their safety and benefit. Now your majesty is the lord of 10,000 chariots. If you were indeed to share the aims of these two men, everyone within your four borders would enjoy the benefit. You would be far greater than Confucius and Motazu. Now, he is buttressing the ego of the king as extremely as possible. He says, "Look, Confucius and Motazu were not kings, but they were almost like uncrowned kings. They had no territory, but they were treated everywhere as great kings. They were men of character, morality, knowledge. They were respected everywhere. They became leaders without holding office. Every man and woman in the world craned his neck and stood on tiptoe in his eagerness for their safety and benefits. But if that is true, then why Jesus was crucified? If that is true, then why Socrates was poisoned? If that is true, then why Mansur al-Hillas was killed? No. Confucius and Motazu are not real masters. Yes, they were men of character, great discipline. But a man of character is nothing but a man who follows the rules and regulations of the society. He is not rebellious. He is a conformist. The society certainly respects him because he respects the rules of the society. Jesus had to be crucified because he rebelled. Mansur had to be killed because he rebelled. The society takes revenge if you don't follow the rules of the society. If you start talking in ways which are sabotaging the foolish rules of the society. The rules are stupid. They are meaningless. But millions of people believe in them. Once a man like Jesus or Socrates or Mansur is there, and he starts talking about truth, and that truth goes against the so-called truths of the society, they are bound to take revenge. But Confucius was respected. He was not a man of rebellion. He was just a conformist, traditional. He followed the neurotic rules of the society, the stupid ways of the society. He follows to the very letter. Yes, he was moral, but he was not religious. A religious man has found his own law. If it fits with the society, good. If it doesn't fit with the society, then too he lives his own law. A religious man is free. A religious man is freedom. He lives through his innermost core. He has no outer imposed discipline on himself. He lives in no cage. He lives like a free being, whatsoever the cost. Even if his life has to be paid for it, he is ready to pay through life, but he is not ready to curtail his freedom. Freedom is his utmost value, ultimate value. Everything he can lose, but not freedom. A traditional man is ready to lose freedom for cheap things, respectability, social honor. Yes, Confucius and Motazu was honored. They were really honored. But the honor was because they were not free men, not men of Tao. Now your majesty is the lord of 10,000 chariots. If you were indeed to share the aims of these two men, everyone within your four borders would enjoy the benefits. You would be far greater than Confucius and Motus. Now he is saying that you can become the greatest man in the world because Confucius is the last word. You can become even greater than Confucius. Look, that is the way of the society to persuade everybody. A child is born and the parents start telling him, be moral, have character, do this and that, and you will be respected. And the whole society will respect you. You will become a great man, famous, well-known, well-respected. What they are doing? They are creating the ego. They are helping to create the ego in the child. No, ego is the principle of immorality. And your so-called morality hangs on the principle of ego. It is based on immorality. But you have been taught to be this way. Be the way the society wants you to be, and the society will respect you. If you want the respect, never rebel. If you want the respect, bow down to the order of the society. And who is this society? The mob, the crowd. The majority consists of stupid people. They control. The society means the lowest mob that controls everything. Yes, it will respect you if you follow it. But following it, you will become stupid yourself. If you want to be respected, then you will have to become stupid. If you want to be intelligent, forget about respectability. An intelligent person will live tremendously, live greatly, live joyously, but he should not hanker for respect. Disrespect is more possible than respect. Poison is more possible than prestige. You may be beheaded, that is more possible, rather than honor. Because the society has not yet come to the point of growth. It has not evolved so much that it can respect the real persons. That has to be understood. If Socrates comes back, he will be again poisoned. If Jesus comes back, he will be again crucified. Time has not made much difference. The same. It remains the same. Society has not yet evolved to the point where it can respect a true person. To respect a true person will mean society has become intelligent. The goal seems to be far away. Whether it will ever happen or not seems almost like an utopia. When the day will come when Socrates will be worshipped? Do you remember the people who killed Socrates? Do you know anybody's name? They were the respectable people. They were the guardians of morality and society. Do you remember the name of the judge who sentenced Socrates, who ordered that he has to be poisoned? Do you know who were these people, where they have gone? They were respectable people. They were the guardians of morality. They were the protectors of society. They were the leaders and the politicians and the priests. Nobody knows where they have gone. Socrates remains. It is said, in the last moment, the man who was the opponent, who had brought the case against Socrates in the court, that he corrupts the mind of the young people. That was the crime that he was doing. He corrupts the mind of the young people. That is the crime they say I am doing. I corrupt the minds of the young people. I would like to corrupt the minds of the old people, but they don't have any. So naturally I have to corrupt the minds of the young people. Only they have. the man, when the case was won, he had won the case, and Socrates was sentenced, and the order was declared that he will be poisoned, looked at Socrates and said, "What do you say?" And Socrates laughed and he said, "Remember one thing. For thousands of years, people will think about me. And your name they will remember only because you had put the case against me. That's all. They will know your name only because you were the man who moved the court to kill Socrates. Nothing else will be remembered of you." And exactly that has happened. Nobody remembers anything about them. Socrates will be remembered and remembered. Who were the men who killed Al-Hillaz Mansur? Their names are forgotten. And they were the pinnacle of morality. They were the paradigm of morality. They were the people who were afraid that Al-Hillaz Mansur is destroying morality, religion, a dangerous man. Society has to be protected against this man. But who remembers their name? Even their names are not known. Mansur will live as long as humanity will continue to aspire to go beyond. As long as humanity will have goals to transcend. As long as the arrow of the human consciousness will be moving towards God, Mansur will be remembered. One day, one can hope, somewhere in future, a time will come when the real man will be respected. Confucius is not a real man. Motazu is not a real man. They are conventional people, conformist traditional people, dead. And says Hui Eng, "You would be far greater than Confucius and Motazu." This is the whole trick. How you have been distracted from your center. You have been told not to be yourself, otherwise you will not get any respect, any honor. If you want to be yourself, nobody will give you any respect. So don't be yourself. Be that which the society wants you to be. This is the way how you have been distracted from your center. And you have become pseudo beings, phony, unreal. You are just a mask. You don't have any soul. You have lost your soul. The soul comes into being only when you declare that I am going to be myself. Respect or disrespect. Society or no society. Honor or no honor. That is irrelevant. I have decided to be myself. Because this is my life and I have to live it in my own way. Whatsoever the cost, I will live like a free man. Once you declare that, you become centered. That's the whole effort in sannyas. That's what sannyas is all about. To bring you back to your center. That's why I don't give you any outer discipline. Just the inner consciousness. A awareness. No duty, only a responsibility. No outer pattern. No style from the outside, but an inner flow, an inner glow. To live in that glow, to move into that flow, and allow your life to have freedom. To be in a let go. That's what sannyas is and that's what Tao is. hurried out, and the king said to his courtiers, "Clever, the way he tugged me round with his arguments." It is not clever, it is cunning. It looks clever because all cunningness looks clever. Remember, cleverness, cunningness are not going to hell, only intelligence, awareness, alertness. This man has deceived the king. But my feeling is, you can deceive somebody only if you yourself are deceived. This man is not a master. Otherwise, how can you deceive somebody? Let me tell you another story, just exactly parallel. A great sage came to China. His name was Bodhidharma. The Emperor Wu of China came to receive him on the border. The emperor was waiting for years because Bodhidharma was coming and coming from India. He had to cross the whole Himalayas. It took years. And then he arrived. And the emperor was a little bit puzzled seeing him because he looked a very strange man. The most strange thing was that he was having one shoe in one of his feet and another shoe he was carrying on his head. Now, is this man mad? But the king was a very polite man, cultured, of course. He tried not to see it because that will be. He simply tried not to see it and not to say anything about it. That is too impolite, and this is the first meeting with this great sage, and what type of man he is. But how long you can avoid it? He was just standing there holding his shoe on his head. And the king said, "Sir, you can put it down. Why you are holding it on your head? And in the first place, why you are having it on your head? It is meant for your feet." Bodhidharma said, "I want to make everything clear from the very beginning. That I am this type of man. You can think me mad, or you can think me enlightened. But I am strange. And be clear from the very beginning that you are meeting a strange man. I am absurd, illogical. I am as absurd as this shoe on my head. There is no reason for it. It simply happened. I enjoyed it. And the poor shoe has always been carrying me. Why not I can carry it?" But this was just a vain gesture. He was trying to fathom this man, this Emperor Wu, who had invited him from India, whether he will be able to understand the illogicalness of truth, because truth has no argument to prove it. It is a statement, remember. And when I see Bodhidharma standing there, thousands of people had gathered to receive and all were feeling puzzled. He was a statement, illogical, absurd. He was saying that I am not going to argue. If you have to listen to me, you have to forget argumentation. I am not going to pursue it. I am not here to convince you about anything. I am a simple statement, absurd statement of the truth. I will not give you reasons. There are none. Then Bodhidharma looked at the king. The king was puzzled and he was perspiring. And Bodhidharma said, "Have you something to ask, sir? You have called me from India and it took many years. For what you have called me?" And Buddha said, "I had many questions, but you have confused me. But I will try. First question, I have made so many temples for Buddha, thousands. And I have fed thousands of Buddhist monks. And I have made many monasteries for Buddhist monks and Buddhist nuns. And I have done all this virtuous work. What will be my gain in the other world?" And Bodhidharma said, "Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. If you can escape hell, that will be enough." Bodhidharma said, "The very idea of doing something for gain is irreligious, worldly. So you have not done it because you love. You have done it because you are greedy. Greed will take you to hell. Listen, who? These monasteries and these thousands of monks that have gathered here, they are not going to help you. And I know they must be telling you again and again that, great king, great is your virtue. God will be ready to receive you in heaven. But I tell you, you will go to hell because greed is the door to hell, and you are greedy and you are ambitious. Look at your ugly greed. If you want to make a temple, make it, but make out of love. If you want to feed somebody, feed him, but feed him out of love. Finish. You have had the benefit. There is no other benefit beyond it. You enjoyed feeding a man. What more you need? The value is intrinsic. Act out of love. This is how a master is, a real master. Then he turned away. He didn't enter in the kingdom. And who said, "Why you are turning away?" He said, "When you cannot understand me, what about others? They will not understand me. I will stay outside the kingdom. Those who want me, they can seek and come." And he remained outside the kingdom. He will not enter. He said, "Even the king cannot understand me. Then what about the masses? Your courtiers are standing here puzzled and they cannot understand me. So what about the masses? And these foolish monks who have gathered, they cannot understand me. So I will not come in your kingdom. I will wait outside. Those who are really desirous, they should come to me." And then too, he sat for 9 years outside the kingdom, looking at the wall. People will come and they will say, "Sir, why you are looking at the wall? Why you don't look at us?" And he will say that, he will say, "It is all the same. Whether to look at you or to look at the wall is the same. I will turn only to look at you when the real person has come who wants to know truth." Then came Hui Neng, his first disciple. He stood at the back and he said, "Sir, I have come. Turn towards me." And Bodhidharma said, "Show the sign." And Hui Neng cut his hands, gave it to Bodhidharma and said, "You turn, otherwise I will cut my head, because what else I can show as a sign?" And Bodhidharma turned immediately. And he said, "So you have come?" One has to pay for truth by life. What about respectability, prestige? All nonsense. One has to give all. Only then one becomes capable of knowing the truth. enough for today.